Talk given Saturday, 11th October 1980. To talk about the void, as you will all appreciate, is extremely difficult because it's void of everything. Void of concepts, words, activities as we understand activities, and so forth. One of the very ancient Tibetan scriptures of the world talks in terms of the eternal parent slept for seven eternities. Now, that sleep is perhaps the fundamental concept underlying any teaching which we have in connection with the void. What we are acquainted with in our everyday life is the manifested world and all the events that take place, not only the physical events but the psychological and the spiritual events. These we can comprehend, but we comprehend them not in terms of voidness, but in terms of something manifest, that which is there and which we can conceive of or talk about, therefore. But this fundamental void represents the origin of all manifestation. That is the unmanifest, which is the void. It's empty, as we call it. But it is not empty in the sense of a complete and a total emptiness. It is an emptiness which contains within it the potentiality for creation. You see, the original creative energy which releases a universe into manifestation. About this potentiality, I can say no words whatsoever. One can sense it if one is completely quiet. You see? And this is the problem, to realize that state of quietude in which one's life energy, one's innermost consciousness, is vibrating in tune with that quiescent state of the original creative energy of the universe. And that is perhaps a fundamental meaning of the void as spoken of in the scriptures of the world. Not all the scriptures of the world talk about this. For instance, in Zarathustrianism, in the Gathas of Zarathustra himself, I don't think there is any specific indication of the void. Conceptualizing the void makes it non-void. See, this, and we can't talk without conceptualizing. So, it is the experiencing of the void, the abyss, the crossing of the abyss, as the great mystics of the world have called it, is the only way by which one may go through that state which enables one to use the word void in the sense perhaps in which you mean it when you ask the question. But this void is the origin, the source of everything. The manifest, in the metaphysics, the religious metaphysics of all the world's religions, the manifested universe emerges out of the unmanifest, out of the void, out of no thing. This creative, primordial creative energy released all things. And beyond that, I don't know what I can say about it. Have you any further query about it?
May I say this for us about this? I think this is helpful. I've got a note here. All things are one form and all things are no form. They are not opposed. All phenomena, having no determined self-nature, are born and die in accordance with karmic associations and so are fundamentally the void. They are without form and also with form, and with a form because with form and without form explains the doctrine of form and no limitation.
Now that's a nice puzzle. Is it from Murthy's... I thought so. Sounds like that. T.V.R. Murthy has been one of the people who has given an exposition of Nagarjuna's teachings, you see. Nagarjuna flourished in the 2nd century of our era, didn't he? There was another Nagarjuna too, but this Nagarjuna is the famous one. And it's a tremendously difficult philosophy to follow. It's based upon, it has its roots in the Buddha's teachings. But Nagarjuna, of course, being one of the very profound philosophers, developed these ideas and presented them in that way.
Isn't it more simply expressed by the Buddha when he refers to the unborn, unmade, unbecome? If not for that, there would not be born, made, unmade, unbecome.
Yeah, whereas one sort of hears these things, but they mean nothing.
Yes, of course. We just can't put meanings to them in our ordinary terms. Mm. They completely elude us. Mm. Unless and until one is capable of entering the profound states of consciousness. That is the point. Mm. When one can enter into the profound states of consciousness, into some of the very profound states of consciousness, then all this is as clear as our seeing objects and people in this room. You see, it's a mode of awareness in which the opposites find their resolution, their complete resolution. I'm using the word resolution in the sense in which a musician uses the word resolution. The parts of music move into a position of discord, the different parts, treble, alto, tenor, bass. They move into a position of discord, and then they proceed to move in such a manner that you get your concord. That is the resolution of the discord. It is not a solution of the discord in the sense that you have a solution to a mathematical problem. Not in that sense. It's a curious thing. The discord itself is there by rights. And if it were not there, the concord wouldn't have the meaning that it has and the effect that it has upon the individual. You see, we are made up. Our whole life is an interplay of opposites, of apparently conflicting opposites. But all apparently conflicting opposites can find a proper resolution if oneself is perfectly quiet, and still within one's own mind, you see. And then that resolution takes place, and there is what we commonly call enlightenment. Enlightenment isn't a case of choosing what is right in the profound sense and discarding what is wrong. In the profoundest sense, there is nothing right, nothing wrong. It is we, constituted as we are, who set up these situations where opposites are irreconcilable. This is right, that is wrong. And when one completely transcends that, you will find that everything turns out right. And that's the extraordinary part of the whole story. You see, what has been called in the Bible good and evil, the tov and ra of the Kabbalah, the Hebrew, tov and ra, are what we call good and evil. And as a matter of fact, our interpretation of the words tov and ra is a misinterpretation, for the simple reason that we think of good as just this and evil as just that, the opposite of it, you see. This holds good in most contexts in our ordinary everyday life, because our ordinary everyday life is composed of conflicting opposites, not resolved opposites. I'm using the word resolved in the musical sense. You resolve your discord, you see. But simply because a certain chord is in the position of sounds as a discord, then you move one part of that chord in such a manner as to produce the concordant sound after it. You see? It's like that.
Yes, well, thank you for this.
Are you suggesting that the resolution actually means a change in, say, good and evil? Or is it just a change in our understanding of good and evil?
You see, we call things good and evil fundamentally on the basis of our own sensations. Are they painful? Are they pleasant? You see?
Yes.
What is pleasant, we call good. But that is a mistake. And what is unpleasant, we call evil, which is also a mistake. The pleasure, pain are the keynote, are the criteria for judging good and evil. Opposition holds good ordinarily in the sphere of everyday life, where, say, health and so on are concerned. If you drink 5 bottles of whiskey a day, you'll get evil results. You won't get good results, and so forth. You see, that is what is totally destructive. And destructive in the sense that that which is destroyed has not been allowed to come to its fulfillment, to its fruition. If it comes to its fruition through a good deal of pain and difficulty and sorrow and all the rest of it, that pain and difficulty and sorrow is not evil in the true sense of the word evil. It has served a purpose. It has enabled us to understand fully what is actually present and how we stand in relation to it and how we can deal with it rightly.
Are you saying that, to take the example of good and evil, they are the two sides of the same coin of our conception of the way the world treats us?
Yes, yes. All too often that is the case.
Could you use the analogy of a dialectic spiral, as it were, although not in the sense?
Analogy of the dialectic.
It is not, obviously, in a non-political sense. You
Oh, yes, 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 yes. A metaphysical dialectic. Yes.
I don't know that much about it. It's just a very basic.
But
it just seems to explain
so much. Yes.
That's correct.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say positively, this is correct and that is not correct. One has to consider the thing. And I think we could consider it that way. It's a very difficult concept, as presented in those words. The activity of the void. What is implied in that phrase, the activity of the void? This is the problem.
It appears to imply something to be active, but that's not...
We can quite easily conceive of activity in the void. You see, say, here is a room, let us say there are people just seated doing nothing at all, you see, or they may enter into conversation or have a dance or whatever it is, you see. Well, then there is an activity in the void, because for us space, an enclosed space, is what we call an empty space. Just by itself, isn't that so? But whether the empty space itself does anything, when you say activity of the void, it means that that space is doing something, it's producing a result. Of course, I'm using the phrase empty space, but there's no such thing as empty space. It is only a convenient way of talking in relation to things. Here is a box which should have had 100 oranges, but it hasn't. It's empty. There's a void there.
I mean, you can think of it. You can't think of it. Because when you start thinking of void, it's got an end and it's got a beginning, hasn't it?
End and a beginning in which sense?
Well, I mean, it's got a something that contains the void. I mean, it's unthinkable, isn't it?
One can't picture it.
You can't say anything. You can't even in the mind sort of see, picture it in any way. I mean, you can't even make a sort of concept. I mean, once one talks about a box empty of oranges, I mean, that is, you think, I mean, the box has got an end to it. I mean,
yes.
I mean, it's
it's finite.
Yes.
But what is the void where that box is concerned? Is it is it the space which is confined within the wooden box, which is the void, which is empty, or does it include the wooden box? What would you say, Brett? Anybody?
But isn't this just
includes? It includes the box.
Since the box is not void,
isn't this just a sort of playing around with sort of a puzzle sort of thing.
Is it think of it as a state of voidness, or rather than give it a shape? I mean, if you could not imagine the state of voidness, but if you can feel it through what you said without analysing or conceptualising it, that's how I understood. It doesn't worry me about the shape of this or where it is or how you touch it.
don't think it's something you can tie at all. I seem to remember that before you have mentioned in one of your talks that there's some reason now in science to suggest that manifestation and unmanifestation occurs at a very rapid sort of vibratory rate.
Mm.
And you mentioned this, I believe, at one of your summer schools.
Mm.
And that the other state, shall we say, from manifestation is the void.
Mm.
So that without the void, there can be no manifest. And without the manifest, there's no meaning to the void. So that they have to both exist, coexist.
The manifest and the unmanifest coexist,
yeah.
Therefore.
Yeah, one is necessary
to
the other.
Box.
Hmm?
Box, to our senses, is box.
Mm.
But it is also of the void.
Yes.
It's manifest.
Box. Yes. It's that which contains the void.
Yes.
And
is contained by it.
I think, if I am not mistaken, in the teachings of the Kabbalah, If I remember correctly, the primordial space constricts itself, and by the act of constricting itself, only then that it becomes a container. I mean, words like this are very difficult to understand in depth. For in the first place, we can't imagine how space can constrict itself, the original void, how it can constrict itself. By its constriction, it makes itself a container. So the contained and the container actually become an identity then. You see, all this, as Krishnamurti would say, is just words, useless words.
One can experience the expansion of what one normally calls space into something which appears limitless. And that, you know, perhaps one could call that a void. I experienced that then the other day in a very confined space, because I was playing houses with our two children, and I was under the blanket, which was the house, and they were outside the house for some reason. It was my job to sit and wait, and I waited, and my mind fell very quiet, absolutely quiet, and I just felt this great presence inside that confined space, and it was absolutely vast, that space.
You're using the word space in saying that more in the Asian sense. I say Asian meaning in terms of the religious experience and the metaphysics of Asia, specifically, as such. Not in the European sense. In the European sense, space is just a container, like a box, but minus the sides of the box. But European science postulates that space moves. I don't know how it does. I hope this space here doesn't start moving about, otherwise we might all be in a rare old tizzy.
But there's no limit in the mind at all.
You see, mind space, that is with reference to mind space. The word akasha, one of its meanings is mind space, Now, mind space is something quite different from our ordinary experience, our material experience of space, which is our material experience is entirely in terms of a container. It's something which contains. And people have talked of higher space and a transcendent space and so forth and so forth. But what happens to the meaning, the ordinary linguistic meaning of the word space in that case? These are the difficulties.
Isn't the meaning of void, as it was first put, surely the essence of all these different limited spaces? I mean, the physical space, the mind space, and all the others. Isn't it the void, the basis from which all these other spaces are part? Something it's like looking at a diamond and seeing different reflections in different angles. It's all still the same reflection from the same diamond. It's just a different aspect of the same void.
Yes, one can put it that way.
It strikes me as better to regard void as that being which is outside consciousness. Our consciousness, or our functional waveband, is comparatively quite small. A wide range of frequencies below and above and our sensory bands together. This is equally to us void. What is that? We don't know. We have no power to know. As he says, we tend to regard space as a container. And that is necessarily the limits are bound by what we can with finite body be aware of.
Yes?
The space is also within us, to say it at the subatomic level. I gather that an atom is almost entirely space, and what 20 or odd years ago was thought to be little solid particles flying around is no longer solid particles flying around, but just energy.
Exactly.
It appears to be solid.
Exactly. The movement of energies has been talked of as particles. And how many subatomic particles have we arrived at now? So many more than many more than the actual chemical elements. Many, many more. Some 200 and odd or more. Yes.
Because there's subatomic particles or subparticles to the particles.
Yes. This is where language fails. In fact, it in the mind of the person who isn't a physicist and mathematician, it raises up incorrect pictures, particles. That's what made Edward VIII, when he was Prince of Wales, when he was being shown how they bombard the nucleus in of an atom, you see, in the Cavendish laboratory. And he asked, well, how do they take aim? They bombard it, they shoot the nucleus and disrupt it. How do they take aim? You see, after all, a person who hasn't gone very, very deeply into it, it's very difficult to conceive. I mean, take a thing like this integration of space and time, which Einstein presented to the world, the integrated space-time. What on earth does it mean? Can you picture it? I can't. It's unpicturable. But tell me, how much does all this sort of inquiry and discussion conduce to the religious life, which is our fundamental concern and always has been through these almost 19 years now? Is it an intellectual hedonism?
Well, I wondered that actually. I'm not so sure actually.
Mm. Because the depth of metaphysics very definitely has its place in the religious life and in the release of profounder understanding. There's no doubt about that. At least I have no doubt about that. At the same time, unless and until one has arrived at a very considerable purification of the mind, and I mean mind specifically, not in the sense of ordinary ethic, purification of the mind, that is to say, the freedom from preconceptions, assumptions, and so forth, you see, our mental life is so full of all these assumptions and preconceptions and all the rest of it.
Well, that's as we've talked, so concepts have arisen, analogies have been raised.
Well, it's a very healthy state to recognize the fact about it for oneself, that one feels further from it.
There are many dangers if one gets a satisfactory explanation.
Yes. Yes. But
it's... I didn't really want an explanation, you know. I did not ask for an explanation. I mean... but, it's something that, you know, nags one sometimes.
Something which...
It nags you.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, I think I've been...
Thank you.
I think what you said about sitting quiet and through the feelings, you feel thrilled at the presence of the voice,
it stimulates one to... It will, those forces.
The feeling activity is the life side of our psychological life, the feeling activity. Feeling not exclusively in the sense of emotion. Emotion as just emotion is an unbalance, an upheaval. But a feeling activity, which is pure feeling, is something which unites you with that towards which you are feeling. So it produces a very profound inner spiritual harmony. That is perhaps one of the reasons why love has been regarded as the supreme virtue. Because you can't think love as such. You can feel it. Otherwise, it's a lifeless word.
It's lovely when there is observing. It's lovely when there is observing and things speak.
Yes.
Feeling, is it a sensing, rather than feeling as we know it, which is an emotional thing? Is it a...
It's profounder than emotion.
Yes.
You see? The real feeling aspect is much profounder than emotion. One may experience an emotion towards a person in this, that or the other way. But if that person is in difficulty or trouble, one may not respond as a fellow human being. Whereas if there is a real feeling, one will respond as a fellow human being. and do something which is really of a healing nature, a whole-making nature. It is feeling which makes whole. Thinking merely structures, you see. Now you see all those buildings over there, the new buildings which have been made, and all the, what are these pipes and things, the scaffolding. Thought does the scaffolding part, if you like. But the feeling part is the real vital living part of the whole story. And emotion as such, we generally regard emotion as that which is an upheaval or an upset. And we think it a great virtue to control our emotions, as we call it. Controlling emotions will produce even greater upset. But understanding the emotion is a very different thing. Now this is where the perception part comes in, which is not mere thinking. It is thinking which has the life energy of feeling involved in it. And then there is ultimately the resolution of the discord, and you have a concord. In connection with what you have said, one should inquire, is it possible to learn to love? Learning is a perceptive process. It's a perceiving process. That's learning, isn't it? But can one bring in an intellectual technique to bear upon love? Love is an inevitable, natural outgoing, something which includes the other person or persons or the situation or whatever it is, includes quite naturally and spontaneously. If it is something which is thought out and has an intellectual energy behind it, then one will react against that person if that person says, does something which hurts us or we don't like or we think is wrong, etc. One loves in the fullest sense irrespective of what the other person is. The only love is transcendent love, the absolute love. All the rest is just the usual attraction-repulsion game. A little bit the Punch and Judy show.
To me, love isn't something you do anyway, it's something that you awaken to. It's that it was there all along. You just suddenly realize that there is love.
Love lays down no conditions. Love doesn't demand anything. Love is like, say, the sunlight. It just spreads out, enlightening everything. Only that is not a very good verbal expression, because enlightenment is so tied up with the mind and intellectual perception and so on. But what we separate the two, mind and heart, the thinking process, the feeling process. Actually, they are only one activity. It's according to the emphasis of that activity that we call it love or perceiving. But they go together. Is it possible to love a person you have never seen or heard of or anything? You can't. You know, the Buddha occasionally uses that simile. He tells the person to who has come to question him, you are like a person who says that you are in love with the belle of the village, but have you seen her? Do you know her? etc., etc., etc. And if you haven't, what are you in love with? A fantasy.
That Jesus was talking about in the Bible, speaking about just now, and the others are punk and Judy, so you'd say. And isn't that what happens mostly on the plane we live? You fall in love, you fall out of love.
Well, that isn't love, you see.
This is what most people understand, and this is what actually happens in practice.
Yes, that is true.
He's got this other kind of love, which is a kind of a super love.
The wholeness and the reality of love is something where there is no exclusiveness whatsoever. The other person is wholly included. And so there is this unconditional love. That's the point. I mean, after all, any two friends, there is a situation of conditionality between them. Take the marriage services of the world. There too, husband and wife, there is the element of conditionality, etc., love, honor and obey and so forth. Or nowadays it's more love, honor and disobey, because you want to emphasize your individuality and so forth. You see, all these things are absent. When you love, you just love, and that's that. Absolutely. This is why parental love is perhaps one of the supreme expressions of love. I mean, you know that. you can't help it. You love the boy, you love the child, you see, and that's that. Whether he's a swine of a fellow, or whether he's a saint or a sinner, whatever he is. In that sort of situation, there is no selfness at all, no vested interest, and therefore no demand of a response in any shape or form from the other. But that sort of love means that one's own mind and heart are purified already. Otherwise, one can't have that kind of all-embracing consciousness of another. One is in perpetual union with the Holy Beloved. It never disappears.